The European Union expresses concerns about Iran's move to enrich uranium to higher levels and calls on Tehran to reverse the decision. A rights group denounces Israel as an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. And UN human rights experts urge the incoming U.S. administration to close the notorious Guantanamo military prison 19 years after it was first opened. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Our top story, the European Union is asking Iran to reverse its decision to enrich uranium at higher levels. In a statement, the EU expressed concerns over the country's move to enrich uranium at 20%. The bloc says this is a very serious development, and Iran started taking that measure last week at Fordo nuclear facility. Enrichment is part of the country's measures in response to non-compliance by other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran says that the European signatories have failed to compensate for the 2018 U.S. withdrawal from the accord. The pullout restored sanctions against Iran. The country says it will fully abide by its nuclear commitments once other parties meet their own obligations. International lawyer Barak Grossman says that the European signatories to the Iran deal and the UN nuclear watchdog are not ideally entitled to lecture Tehran on the nuclear agreement.
What we have here is a situation where both the European signatory countries and the United States have grossly violated their obligations under the JCPOA and therefore relieved Iran of any legal obligation to make good on its obligations, at least in the short term, until some solution can be found. We now have the head of the nuclear watchdog coming forward and presuming to lecture Iran about the need to return to the fold and stop its current level of enrichment within a couple of weeks, somehow forgetting that his agency, the agency which he is nominally the head of, is not in any kind of doesn't have an enforcement role, has no kind of a policy making role or a political role. It is simply a monitoring agency, and a monitoring agency which has consistently failed to call out Israel and the United States for their violations of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and international law more generally when it comes to nuclear matters.
In other news, the Iranian Navy is set to be reinforced with a domestically made forward base ship and a missile launching destroyer. The Macron sea base ship and the Zara missile launcher will join the fleet on Wednesday, the first day of naval exercises in the southern Sea of Oman. Macron is the country's biggest military vessel that serves as a helicopter carrier. It'll support Iran's Navy forces in distant waters, such as the northern Indian Ocean region, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and the Red Sea. Meantime, Zara enjoys high maneuverability and speed and is armed with advanced missiles and automatic cannon. It'll further enhance the Navy's capabilities in protecting Iranian waters. Iran has repeatedly stressed its commitment to regional peace and security, saying that its military might only serves defensive and deterrent purposes. An Israeli rights group says that Tel Aviv is an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian land. B'Tselem says that Tel Aviv has created a system over all the territory in which Jewish citizens have full rights. And that's why the Palestinians are divided into tiers with different levels of rights, but always below those of Jewish people. B'Tselem says that Israel has effective control over the Gaza Strip, which the regime has blockaded. In the West Bank, Palestinians are living in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and without political rights. B'Tselem is a non-profit organization that documents human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied territories. Mona Kandil says that Israel treats the Palestinians as if they are the minority and they aren't the real owners of the land.
It's the first time that B'Tselem is accusing Israel of apartheid. the report issued by B'Tselem saying that what Israel is doing on ground, it's not democracy and occupation, as it claims that the Israeli authorities occupy the West Bank, besiege the Gaza Strip and a part of Jerusalem. Al-Quds on ground, what's going on is apartheid between river and the sea, because at the time the Israelis are occupying the West Bank, we are speaking about, let's say, 62% of the West Bank, where settlements are being built on a private Palestinian lands and on mountains, on hills. Jews are living there. They are having their full rights. Everything they want, they receive. At the same time, Palestinians, who are the real owners of the land, they are not receiving their rights. They are being arrested, shot, killed. Every day, Israeli forces storm the Palestinian lands in the occupied West Bank and arrest people. They confiscate their lands in order to annex it to the settlement. So they continue to treat the Palestinians as they are minority and that they are not the real owners of the land.
The U.S. has done it again with its sanctions regime. It sanctioned the Ansarallah movement and some of its key officials. A U.S. Secretary of State made that announcement, meant to take place on January 19th, just one day before the inauguration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. The decision will adversely affect the humanitarian situation of the country, which is suffering from 6 years of war.
The Trump government enters its last day in office. Every effort is being taken by the White House and the State Department to divert attention away from its woeful behaviour at home and making sure that the international arena gets one last taste of Trumpism. The United States has introduced a fresh round of sanctions against the Yemeni Ansarullah resistance movement, going as far as labelling the group as a designated terrorist organisation. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stated that he had declared three senior leaders of the movement as global terrorists, including Abdulmalek al-Houthi. However, it seems that by acting in this way, the US has done nothing to alleviate the ongoing war in the region, in particular when it comes to the terrible humanitarian disaster taking place in Yemen, which for the whole part sees the US and its regional allies wholly responsible for. With war raging on in the country, it seems that many people have forgotten about the disastrous impact on human life, with over 233,000 Yemenis dying from the impact of the conflict. It's hence why the Ansarallah movement has highly condemned the actions of Mike Pompeo, as well as the lack of actions by the UN humanitarian team, who has failed to act, in essence, making them equally as guilty as the Americans for their lack of positive action. With very little to no humanitarian aid being able to enter the country, has the actions by Trump and Pompeo made things harder for life-saving drugs, equipment and medicine to reach the country?
The U.S. is the source of terrorism, and this latest decision actually doesn't... the Yemeni people don't care about it because the United States is already killing Yemenis and they are already apart in this coalition war and blockade against Yemen. And he said that the Yemeni as well reserve the right to respond to this latest action from the United States.
Although not all lives have been taken from the impact of the war, it's the connected impact that has hit Yemen the hardest, with many people, especially children, who are suffering the most, either through the lack of clean, potable drinking water, lack of fresh and healthy, nutritious food, and of course through lack of much-needed medical supplies, in particular as Yemen, like all other global nations, is facing a pandemic that knows no borders.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the sanctions on Yemen's Ansarallah movement over the weekend. The important point is that the move would exacerbate the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen that's facing Saudi war and blockade for nearly 6 years. The U.S. sanctions could also jeopardize any future talks between opposing sides in Yemen. Ansarallah has been quick to react to the sanctions and the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist organization. Now, Ansarallah is saying that the Yemeni people do not care about the designation. The U.S. is complicit in the killing of the Yemenis and has promised to retaliate the American move.
When it comes to Yemen, the relentless campaign by the Saudi regime has caused a terrible loss of life and economic infrastructure to the country. Yet, every fire is being fueled from somewhere, and it's the United States that are fanning the flames in this case. In fact, in a similar last-minute action by the US on designating the Ansar Allah movement a terrorist group, the US has also struck a last-second deal to supply the Saudi regime with $290 million worth of arms, most of which, again, will be used in the war against Yemen, whilst at the same time funding the US military complex with the same brushstroke. But it's not just the Saudi regime that's guilty of crimes against Yemen. Its regional partner, the United Arab Emirates, is also embroiled in the war, and much like its neighbour in Riyadh, Abu Dhabi has also enjoyed the support of the US arms industry, securing a $23 billion arms deal with Washington, signed and sealed by none other than Donald J. Trump. With over 3,000 children killed since 2015 in Yemen, over 5,600 injured, and many more being added to the list on a monthly basis, why then are the people of Yemen being sanctioned and punished, yet those responsible for the atrocities are being rewarded by the US?
For the last 6 years, it was the political wing of the government here in Sana'a who had the upper hand in making decisions, and I believe now the time has come for military wing to take action, and they can stop the war by directly targeting Saudi Arabia and targeting United Arab Emirates. And this decision, it just shows that the United States policy in the region and how Trump actually dealing with the effort that has been Martin Griffith has been trying to do.
With Trump having promised to end endless wars, why then does he continue to fund his regional allies, allowing the US to continue its global conflicts via its proxies? And will the arrival of a new US president spell any notion of change in US foreign policy, allowing the likes of Yemen to rise from the ashes and fight the humanitarian disaster that struck this ancient land?
A group of UN human rights experts has urged the incoming US administration to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, ASAP. In a statement, the experts said that the very existence of the facility is a disgrace for the U.S. and the international community. They described conditions at Guantanamo as inhumane and cruel, saying that a prisoner's health is worsening rapidly. The UN rights experts say that the military prison is a place of abuse where the rule of law is suspended. Ill treatment is rampant in Gitmo and remains institutionalized. The experts issued their statement on the 19th anniversary of the establishment of Gitmo. The world body says currently 40 inmates are held there. Only 9 have been charged with or convicted of crimes. A wave of resignations is sweeping through the U.S. administration following the siege of the Capitol by pro-Donald Trump protesters. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf says he is 7 down. He is the 3rd cabinet official to quit his job in the aftermath of the attack. And that in the midst of a growing list of resignations by White House aides. In the meantime, counterterrorism prosecutors have opened probes into the Wednesday storming of the Congress building. The raid claimed 6 lives, including 2 police officers. Federal authorities have made dozens of arrests on several charges, including domestic terrorism. A group of U.S. House Republicans are planning to introduce a censure resolution against President Trump over his supporters' attack on the Capitol last week. Republican Tom Reed says the resolution will be introduced on Tuesday as an alternative to impeachment of the president. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called a censure measure the abdication of lawmakers' responsibility. The Democratic-led House has given President Trump one last chance on Tuesday to leave office or face an impeachment. The chamber is planning to vote as soon as Wednesday on the articles of impeachment if Trump refuses to quit. The president is accused of inciting the violence on the Capitol as he kept refusing to concede defeat in the November presidential election.
The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives is expected to consider launching an impeachment process against the U.S. president on Wednesday. The Democratic lawmakers say they will move ahead with the measure if Vice President Mike Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment, an article that would immediately unseat the president if he is deemed unfit for office.
That's going to be very difficult to achieve, one, because I don't think Vice President Pence is inclined to do so, probably viewing it as political suicide for his future in case he wants to run for president in the future. So I don't think that one's likely. In the context of impeachment, it is a political process. And right now, I think the will is there by the Democratic Party, and it seems like even some Republicans may be interested.
So far, we've seen an unwillingness of Pence, in particular, to move forward with the 25th Amendment, and Trump, of course, is not taking responsibility or taking it upon himself to resign, as he has been called upon to do. So I'm not surprised that impeachment is likely to be the result.
Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers are calling for Trump's removal from office, citing his conduct and rhetoric. Experts say the lack of bipartisan balance in the calls, however, can put U.S. national security at risk.
I think there's certainly a risk of something atrocious happening. I hope, hearing that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, had been in contact with Pentagon officials, there may be some checks, but it does reveal somewhat of a danger in our process in terms of how powerful the executive is, and maybe we should think about that in the future.
The longer he remains in office, he still has access to all kinds of classified information and security codes. He has been isolating himself, which elevates the level of uncertainty about his actions in the coming days and weeks. So, yeah, I think there's definitely reason to be concerned about our overall security.
Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi underlined the urgency to remove Trump by speaking with Pentagon officials about safeguards of the president's access to the nuclear codes in the last days of his presidency.
To make matters worse for Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice hasn't ruled out filing charges of insurrection, sedition, and attempted coup against him. Ronnie Curvello, reporting from Miami.
The number of coronavirus fatalities in Iran has surpassed 56,000. The country has reported more deaths in one day. Health Ministry spokeswoman Seema Lari says that 98 people succumbed to the disease, while more than 6,000 contracted the virus since Monday. Overall, confirmed cases now standing at nearly 1.3 million. Health Ministry saying that more than 1 million people have managed to recover. Iran has reported a downward trend in the number of infections and deaths since November, when it implemented countrywide restriction measures to curb the outbreak. Now, in the meantime, Japan saying it's isolating and analyzing a new strain of the coronavirus that was detected there over the weekend. The new variant was detected on 4 passengers who had arrived from Brazil. The Japanese Health Ministry says there is yet no evidence to show whether the new strain is more dangerous or transmissible. It says, however, the new variant holds similarities to those recently discovered in the UK and South Africa. Now, this happening amid the country's struggle to contain the pandemic, Japan has declared a state of emergency in several western regions to battle the virus. Indonesian authorities have found one of the 2 black boxes of an airliner that crashed into the sea on Saturday. Authorities say that the plane's flight data recorder was found during a search operation off Jakarta port Tuesday. It'll take up to 5 days to read the data on the device. Authorities are optimistic the plane's cockpit voice recorder will also be found soon. The cause of the crash has remained unknown, as crew reported no emergency or technical problems. 62 people, including 10 children, were on board a plane when it crashed. Divers have found a number of bodies, but only one has been identified. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Limelight. With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the U.S. economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of families unable to buy food or pay their rent. We now present you an article written jointly by Christopher Rugeber and Alexander Olson. The piece is titled, Once Again, Job Losses Fall Unequally Across the U.S. Economy. The article has been published by the Associated Press News Agency. Months into America's viral outbreak, low-income workers are still bearing the brunt of job losses, an unusual and harsh feature of the pandemic recession that flattened the economy last spring. In December, the nation shed jobs for the first time since April. Once again, the layoffs were heavily concentrated in the industries that have suffered most because they involved the kind of face-to-face contact that is now nearly impossible. Restaurants, hotels, theaters, sports arenas, and concert halls. With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of American families unable to buy food or pay their rent. Typically in a recession, layoffs strike a broad array of industries, both those that employ higher and middle-income workers and those with lower paid staff, as anxious consumers slash spending. Economists had worried that the same trend would emerge this time. Instead, much of the rest of the economy is healing, if slowly and fitfully. Factories, whilst not fully recovered, are cranking out goods and have added jobs even every month since May. Home sales have soared 26% from a year ago, fueled by affluent people able to work from home while looking for more space. That trend has in turn bolstered higher-paying jobs in banking, in insurance and real estate. Brad Hirschbein, an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, and Harry Holzer, an economist at Georgetown University, concluded in a new research paper titled Such Differences in Employment Loss Between the Highest and Lowest Wage Workers are almost certainly unprecedented among U.S. recessions over the past 100 plus years. On the surface, the December jobs report the government issued on Friday, 10th of January, was absolutely dismal. The economy lost 140,000 jobs. It was a sixth straight month in which the hiring has slumped from the previous month. Unemployment remained stubbornly high, at 6.7%, but the negative number stemmed entirely from the brutal loss, nearly 500,000 jobs lost, in a category that includes restaurants, hotels, and entertainment. State and local government also cut workers, so did hair salons and other personal services. There were layoffs too in education. Nearly every other industry added jobs. Construction gained 51,000 jobs, financial services 12,000 jobs, transportation and warehousing companies, beneficiaries of a surge in e-commerce and delivery services amid the pandemic, gained nearly 47,000 jobs. Hirschbein said in an interview, job losses have definitely been very heavily concentrated in certain industries, much more so than prior recessions. Once the coronavirus vaccine becomes distributed more widely, and the latest government aid packages is pumped into the economy, more analysts expect a solid recovery to kick in this summer. The incoming Biden administration, along with a now fully Democratic-led House and Senate, will also likely push additional rescue aid and spending measures that, as they claimed, could accelerate economic growth. Economists note that the $2 trillion aid package the government enacted in March, which included generous unemployment benefits and aid to small companies and businesses, did more to prevent layoffs from spending than many analysts had expected. But a big unknown overhangs the 2021 economy. Will the economic recovery come fast enough and be robust enough to absorb many of the Americans who've lost their jobs in the hospitality industries into more resilient sectors of the job market? For now, the resurgent pandemic has made consumers reluctant to shop, travel, dine out, and congregate in crowds, and led states and cities to reimpose stricter limits on restaurants. The trend has upended the lives of people like Brad Pierce of West Warwick, Rhode Island, in New York. Brad Pierce had gradually built up a career as a stand-up comedian, only to see it derailed by the pandemic and restrictions on the places that he performed. Now he wonders if that life will ever return. Even when the centers where Brad Pierce worked had reopened, they couldn't offer live entertainment because of coronavirus restrictions. He fears some of these venues won't survive. Brad Pierce receives about $500 a week in unemployment aid, and his wife still works as a healthcare technician, busier than ever because she administers COVID-19 tests. Though he feels fortunate financially, the contrast sometimes depresses him. Brad Pierce, a 40-year-old, said, "She's working all the time whilst I can't work, and it's a terrible feeling as a husband and a spouse." In the meantime, there have been odd gigs for him here and there. The weirdest was a stand-up routine he did via Zoom for a company's holiday party. He asked the employees to unmute so he could hear them laughing, only to be hit by a cacophony of dogs barking, kids yelling, and television sets blaring. He spent the rest of the gig watching his audience silently, moving lips to see if they might be laughing. Brad Pierce said, "I have days where I think I will come back, and days where I think, well, I guess I'll never work again." Hirschbein and Holzer's research found that job losses have been deeper among blacks and Hispanic workers than among whites, and also more pronounced for those in lower-paying jobs. Hirschbein found employment amongst the lowest-paid one-quarter Americans has sunk nearly 12% since February of this year. Among the highest-paid quarter, it's declined less than 3.5%. Hirschbein said the proportion of white Americans with jobs has fallen 6% since the pandemic. Among black and Hispanic Americans, it's down 10%. This means that at some portion of the pandemic, job losses become permanent. Non-white workers will be hurt the most. Michelle Holder, an economist at John Jay College, noted that the two biggest sources of job losses amongst black women have been cashiers at stores and restaurants, including fast food outlets and in childcare. She said she fears that many of those jobs likely won't return, even as the pandemic fades away, as some shifts in the economy become permanent. Business travel won't likely return to its previous levels as more meetings are conducted remotely. Many healthcare appointments are now held online, thereby reducing the need for some staffers in doctors' offices. That may end a decades-long narrowing of the black-white unemployment gap, given that many lower-paid jobs are disproportionately held by black workers. Michelle Holder said, "There are significant changes coming in terms of where we work, what jobs will be available," she added. "All this will hit women, low-wage workers, and people of color. As the pandemic recession rages on, more small businesses have been forced to close. This trend threatens to become a long-term drag on the job market because new companies will have to be created to absorb many laid-off workers." David Gilbertson, vice president at UKG, a company that makes employee time management software, said, "Among his firm's clients with fewer than 100 employees in March, 13% have now closed, more than double the figure in a typical year. Another round of small business loans included in the $900 billion aid package approved last month will be crucial to help prevent another wave of closings." David Gilbertson said, "They've made it this far and now they're on the brink of having to close down. In the meantime, the struggling jobless include people who have forged independent careers, people like Brian Blue, who quit his job as an equipment repairman in Kansas City a year ago to become a full-time musician in Las Vegas, Nevada. Before the pandemic, Blue typically played bass guitar in bands at venues several nights a week. He is unsure that Vegas music scene will ever return to what it was. Blue, who hasn't played a gig since March, is now wrestling with whether to give up hope of rebuilding his music career. For now, he's working as a delivery driver for a sandwich shop, earning $9 an hour before tips. He receives unemployment benefit depending on how much he earns with his job in a given week." Blue, a 46-year-old, said, "Time will tell, I guess. It's been a difficult pill to swallow."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Dieter. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Schachdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Schachwachner Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can little by little show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament.
Our people are waiting us to start writing the constitution.
They wrote one article of the constitution.
There's a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States, but you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embrace the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it was interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married, they have their first babies, they both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world. How do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution. And her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna,
who's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab.
Right. So she wants to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, mm-hmm. whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic, which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you know, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hope for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community.
It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue, that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view where she talks a lot about, you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage and your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about, this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, mm-hmm. rather than looks like a Western democracy. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that there are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it. But they come across the same issues where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issue attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issue. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was this...
Actually, we're going to touch that on that a bit later on.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste. This harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman who is well supported by her Islamic, her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be Emna, who wants to be like Sweden or France, her husband, who has spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke. He goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, you know, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas yes. the others didn't.
Yes. I mean, it is actually a very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting because she's, you know, she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to where she's saying because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it because people want to find their own way through democracy. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually fund, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is, I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently, I mean, historically speaking, recently free, though independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamists tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR exercise, as you mentioned. But of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and a failed monarchy to, you know, to finally be a democracy. So I think we need to give it time. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state.
I think, yeah, we're going to discuss more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary. It was Emna who was supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what are some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces? Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. The personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than
Jawahara. Oh, really? Why is that?
But what is interesting as well, I knew very little about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator Ben Ali, was it?
Yeah.
He was a secularist. And when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So the points that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important, because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. And you know, in the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary. I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Johara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. I know, can you explain that?
Yes, I want to ask Catherine, well, actually. Could you give us
Well, women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, you know, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards, and which is why he was, you know, quite well liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. And the sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emna wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary where Johara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how they have to smash the terrorist stereotypes and work together. What did you make of that scene?
Well, I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that there was...
Both facing the Muslims and the secularists.
Yeah,
the
I mean...
Isn't just the Muslim problem.
Indeed. But there is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film, and Juara says, this is awful, this is not what my father taught me, this is not what is in the Quran, we must fight it.
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital. It's in Bardo. It's in the museum, next to the parliament, and especially I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me, and this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. Then, okay, we have to fight them.
There was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part, and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? You know, it's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, it's another universal point that she's making there.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? We saw briefly there was an issue of terrorism.
Yeah. Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off. And it's a blueprint for that, you know, it's a compounding of everything. All the issues that, you know, other countries in the Middle East are facing right now, which is terrorism, you know, the discussion, you know, secularism, Islamism, what do we do? Could we find, you know, another way? And, you know, I think her silence, you know, speaks volume, really. And it's really moving, because what do you say in the face of you know, radicalism. What do you say before terrorism? Terrorism doesn't speak for any religion. So, you know, here it's Islam, but, you know, it could be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it doesn't matter. There is no religion that, you know, preaches, you know, violence. It's just ludicrous. It's a political construct. And I think that what you have here is the desire, you know, is this attempt to have pluralism. Mm-hmm. And this is what I heard, you know, throughout the documentary.
Acceptance and tolerance.
Yes, that people need to find a way to live together, to find a way to disagree, but not hate each other. You can hate each other's ideas. It doesn't mean you have to hate each other and enact on that hatred. And I think this is the main issue that you have, is that people have been taught, for whatever reason, that they live to live in this kind of binary construct where they have to be either, you know, on this side or that side, hate each other or love each other. It doesn't have to be this way. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that a lot has to do with the way that the revolution was spoken out in the media. You know, that kind of imprinted this idea, again, that they have to be against each other. Clearly, those two women have very similar paths. You know, even like I said, they're sitting on different sides of the river. But again, they're facing the same challenges. They just approach them differently.
And Carol, would you agree, is there a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media?
I think there probably is. Of course, I'm not in a position to know what's false and what's not. But yes, Catherine is absolutely right when she says that we can live together with different viewpoints. I hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And that's what we need to actually get, not just in Tunisia and not just in the UK, but throughout the world.
And this is one of the most powerful messages you get from the documentary.
Yes, yes.
And so we're nearing the end of the film and this programme now, and I'm just wondering, what would you have liked to have seen in the documentary also?
What would I... well, I would have liked a little bit more explanation of the context. I got a little bit confused. I was very aware there was a Democratic Islamic Party because Joël Ara was part of it. They were taking a heck of a long time over writing the Constitution, somebody pointed out. A bit like Brexit, really. and then, suddenly, when the President... or was he the Prime Minister, I can't remember, decided to cede and say, OK, we'll have another election. Suddenly the Constitution was in place. I didn't realise how quickly that could be. So there were certain things about clarity which I would criticise.
Would you recommend the film, Final 30 Seconds to
You? Oh, yes, I'd be very interested. It's American. I don't know where it's been shown in America. It's a sort of film that might crop up on BBC 4 or Channel 4 or something here. And I think it would be an interesting one for us all to watch.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.